This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, or whatever your time zone across this beautiful planet Earth of ours. Welcome, everybody, back to the People Speak radio show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than Barry Chomish in a bagel shop. We're talking to a very special guest right here, a respected journalist, a published author, and a brilliant 9/11 researcher. We're talking tonight to the amazing Christopher Bolin about his two books called Solving 9/11 and his current American speaking tour called Solving 9/11 Ends the War. Welcome to the People Speak show, Mr. Bolin, sir.
Hello, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
It's fantastic to have you, that's for sure. We'll be taking audience questions very soon, but my first question to you is, what inspired you to get started researching into 9/11?
Well, I was an investigative journalist when it happened, and I happened to be passing through New York City with my family early in the morning, very early in the morning before the planes hit, and it fell exactly into my lap because my specialty was actually investigating government cover-ups of big atrocities in which a lot of civilians die.
Was this with your job with the American Free Press that you were reporting for?
Yes, yes. And I actually had been working for IBM because I had been working for 6 or 7 years on the Estonia catastrophe, which was a shipwreck in the Baltic Sea in which 1,000 people died, and which evidently Sweden and Finland and Estonia and other countries participated in a cover-up. And, you know, I worked on that for a long time, and I really wanted to get that information out to the public about that cover-up. And then, you know, Flight 800 went down in my first year at American Free Press. I mean, that's when the plane actually went down, but when the NTSB revealed their final conclusions, in which they dismissed eyewitness testimony wholesale. And then I realized that the United States had the same problem as Sweden had, and that it would cover up a mass catastrophe like 9/11. And I was on the job for already about a year and a half when 9/11 occurred.
Now, you first came to the mainstream media's attention when you went on CNN and was berated and tried to be smeared as some sort of anti-Jew hater. But your whole contention was it wasn't really Jews that did it. These were ultra-national radical Zionists. Is that not true?
Oh, yeah. It's a very small group of Israelis that are and supporters of these Israelis who are tied to the Likud coalition of Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister. And, you know, the Likud coalition that controls Israel since 1977 is a party of terrorists. And the people who were the terrorists in Palestine in the 30s and 40s created this party in 1973. And Menachem Begin, the head of the party, came to power in 77. Their entire modus operandi is terrorism. And so when this party came to power, it was pretty clear there would be more of the same. And so it's a very small group. It's not all Israelis, and it's certainly not all Jews. It's a very small subset of the Zionist enterprise.
Right, right. And their end game, you believe, is a greater Israel?
Oh, yeah, sure. That's a part of their end game. And also their end game is a large-scale ongoing conflict between Europe and the West and the United States against Islam.
One of the first articles I saw you write many, many years ago was talking about Jacoby Alexander and the instant messaging service Odigo. Can you tell the audience here about this software programmer, who he was and what his role was?
Yes. These are people from the Israeli military who came to the United States and they had a company in New York called Odigo. And Odigo was a instant messaging software that would send messages out to large groups of people that weren't necessarily friends, but you could choose, for example, parameters like, say, I want to send this message to everybody who identifies as an Israeli and I want to send the message in Hebrew, and I want to send it. And so that way they had a program called Buddy Finder, and it's like a derivation of Facebook, and it would send out this message to everybody who was Israeli and everybody who spoke Hebrew. And the message was probably in Hebrew. And this Kobe Alexander, he created this program, this company with Comverse and Odigo, and this is what was used on September 11th. This program was used to warn people not to go to work that day at the World Trade Center.
And that was very, very definitely sent. You can confirm that?
Oh yeah, it was reported. It was the FBI sent people over to Israel to verify and find out who had actually sent this message, because the company in Israel, several employees of Odigo that were Israel-based, reported getting this message. So the FBI sent some people over there, and the message, the actual contents of the message was never revealed to the American people, and the actual investigation never went much further than that. But the vice president of the company, Alex Diamandis, he confirmed to the media that the message had been precise as to the attack at the World Trade Center, and that it was precise to the minute.
Wow. So this is a glaring piece of evidence of foreknowledge.
Yes, and you see, the thing was is that this fits hand in glove with another fact of 9/11, and that is that the Israeli Foreign Ministry reported that there were 4,000 Israeli nationals, Israeli citizens, who were expected to have been in the area of the World Trade Center or the Pentagon on 9/11. And their families had contacted the Foreign Ministry in Israel, you know, asking for any information about the whereabouts of their loved one. And the thing is that of this 4,000 people who were expected to have been in the areas that were affected, only four people actually were killed, and the four Israelis were actually killed. So Israelis, you know, survived with very few casualties on 9/11. And, you know, this message that went out several hours before on Odigo appears to have been the device by which these people, their lives were saved.
Right, right. Can you tell the people in the audience listening, what role do you think the Dominic Suter and the Urban Moving Systems, what role did they play in the attack on 9/11?
Oh, they were very much part of the setup team, for sure. This was a company in Weehawken, New Jersey, just across the river from the World Trade Center. And it was, you know, these five dancing Israelis who were being sought by the FBI on September 11th at midday. Ted Koppel came on an Associated Press news blip about that five Middle Eastern people were seen videotaping and celebrating the attack on the World Trade Center, and the FBI was looking for them. And when they were actually captured that afternoon in New Jersey, they turned out to be Mossad agents. Two of them were Mossad agents, and the other three were like operatives working under these two. And these guys were arrested by the FBI. Their van was tested positive for explosives. They had multiple passports. They had thousands of dollars stuck in their pant legs, in their socks, you know. And they had been cheering and giving high fives to each other and clicking their lighters as the World Trade Center was burning behind them in the background. And they were observed and they were arrested. And these chaps, all five of these guys, were working for Urban Moving Systems. And this was a front operation. This was a Mossad front. And this was verified by an FBI agent reporting this to the Forward newspaper, which is a Jewish newspaper in New York City. So it was a front company that was made to look like a moving company, but it didn't do any moving. But what it did is it moved people around who were involved in 9/11, like logistics and the bad guys. And this is this company, when you read about Urban Moving Systems, you can see that they were very happy when 9/11 happened. The people that worked there were elated that the United States had paid a huge price and many thousands of people had been killed.
Right, right. And for those people who haven't heard of it, have you heard of Operation Talpiot? I consider this one of the most glaring facts of Israeli spying across the world. Have you heard of that, and can you summarize it for us?
No, I don't know about Operation Talpiot. I don't know. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay. It's an operation whereby they get university students and those from Israeli universities and put them directly through military training and set them up with small companies, similar to Odigo, within the telecommunications companies all around the world. I thought perhaps maybe you've heard of that.
No, No, I hadn't. But, you know, they do all kinds of things like that. They Mossad even has a university. You know, they have a university called the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel, which is run by all the former chiefs of the Mossad. And they, you know, Ronald Lauder, the son of Estee Lauder from in New York, actually, you know, he has a college there. He has a school of diplomacy and government there. And Ronald Lauder is a key. Go ahead.
Oh, you're talking about Ronald Lauder's son, the guy who runs Estee Lauder?
Yeah, Estee Lauder's, yeah, that's his son, is Ronald. And Ronald, yeah, he's an older guy now, but he like I said, he has a college. He has a college of government and strategy at this Mossad University in Herzliya. But he's also, he's very important because he was the person who operated, who was the director of New York State's privatization scheme, whereby it was decided in like the late 90s that they would privatize the World Trade Center and Stewart Air Force Base, formerly Stewart Air Force Base. And so these properties were determined that they would privatize them, and thanks to Ronald Lauder and Lou Eisenberg from the Port Authority, the properties wound up in the hands of, you know, Mr. Silverstein, Larry Silverstein.
So that's interesting. All, you mentioned... Oh, so sorry, go ahead. Please continue.
It's all... You see, these are the connections that you find in my book, Solving 9/11. What I pointed out is that every single aspect of the 9/11 crime was operated and managed by an Israeli or a person that they call like a Sayan, an American Jew who is supportive of Israeli intelligence operations in this country.
Right, right. It's interesting you mentioned Louis M. Eisenberg. There's some connections there that I made between him, Rupert Murdoch, Larry Silverstein. All of these guys were members of the ADL. They were chair people. Is that not true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Larry Silverstein and Lou Eisenberg were both on the board of directors of an organization called UJA, stands for United Jewish Appeal, and Jewish Federation. Larry Silverstein was the national chairman of that organization, which is the biggest fundraising organization for the state of Israel in the United States. And Lou Eisenberg, who was the Port Authority director and the person who oversaw the negotiations by which the World Trade Center towers were turned over to Larry Silverstein, he was on the same board of directors as Mr. Silverstein in the Zionist organization. So you see, these are the Zionist connections. And you see, most people would be, they would see it politically incorrect, or they would be unwilling to look at these connections. But these are the connections that matter.
Right, right. We're going to take a 30-second break. We'll be right back with the People Speak Radio with Mr. Christopher Berlin, live after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Speak radio show, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very special guest tonight. He's a well-known and respected 9/11 researcher who put out a book called Solving 9/11. You can visit his website at www.berlin.com. Welcome back there, Chris, sir.
Well, thank you. Nice to be with you.
Excellent. What's your personal opinion about 9/11? Do you believe any Muslim hijackers at all were involved in the operation?
No. I think that the it was all a big deception. I think that the planes that struck the towers were modified, weaponized 767 tanker planes that had been modified into weaponized drones. And then whatever was said to have struck the Pentagon was certainly not a large Boeing airframe, and I think that the only Boeing plane that might have been involved, in actually carrying people that was involved, I think might be the shoot down of the plane in Pennsylvania.
And what about the passengers? In your opinion, what happened to them, do you think?
I think what might have happened is that they were all corralled into one plane, and that was the plane that was shot down.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. We have a question here from Ruby today in the United States. Is it true or not that several $1 trillion went missing from the Department of Defense just the day before September 11?
Well, it was announced on September 10th. Donald Rumsfeld announced, at a press conference that something like $2.3 trillion was unaccounted for in the Pentagon budget, and that to have that kind of money go missing is astounding. And the person who was in charge of counting the beings at the Pentagon at that time was a rabbi by the name of Dov Zakheim, who has a degree from Jew University in London. So Dov Zakheim is a problematic person for the whole Zionist neocon thing, because he has a very strong connection to the city of London, and he's an Orthodox rabbi. And the missing money, was discovered on his watch. And the problem is that the very next day, the part of the Pentagon that got struck was a newly renovated section, a wedge, where the people that were in that wedge that was affected were the people that were looking for that missing money.
Right, so they actually got rid of all those who were trying to investigate where that money was gone.
Yes, all of them except for one. All of the whole team of 40 people were all killed.
Right. Well, what are your thoughts about Building 7? Do you believe that third building was supposed to be hit by a plane?
Well, I don't know. They certainly wanted it to come down. There's a very interesting video out there now from a couple years ago where Larry Silverstein, who is the owner of that building, was speaking at an organization called, in Hebrew it's called Building Center on a kibbutz in Israel. And he's speaking, and he's talking about the plans to build a new Building 7. And he said that the design team met to, plan the preparation to build new Building 7 in April of 2000, which is more than a year before 9/11 occurred. And then he's chomping his gum, and he says, and then shortly thereafter, in 2002, work began. But, he's very specific. He's speaking to a Hebrew audience, Israeli audience. And he says that the plans to build the new Building 7, the first design team got together and started making plans in April of 2000. And this is the same guy that was very clear on Nova TV, on public TV in this country, saying that, they made the decision to pull, and then they watched as the building came down. I mean, they're rubbing it in our faces, actually.
I do remember that. That was a PBS interview where Larry Silverstein was quoted as saying, we had such a terrible loss of life. I remember speaking to the fire chief, and we decided to stand back and just pull it. And we watched as the building collapsed. Do you think that's an admission right there, that they actually pre-wired this building to come down?
You do that very well. Yeah, absolutely. You know, they and you know, furthermore, there are news videos and videos of taken of members of the demolition team coming out of the building in the late afternoon, like about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, telling people, get back, the building's gonna come down, get back, keep your eye on that building, it's gonna come down soon. And so it's like, there's no question that the building was demolished. It fell in a classic, you know, demolition operation. The owner of the building talked about it. Demolition teams are seen coming out of the building, telling people to get away, this building's coming down. I mean, there's no question that the building was demolished.
How about Henry Kissinger being led to the initial and but the delayed investigation into 9/11? Do you believe that was a sure sign of an initial cover-up?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, there was a cover. The cover-up began from the very beginning. There was no question about it. But when Bush tried to appoint Kissinger to take the position as being the head of the so-called investigation, yeah, it's pretty obvious. But I mean, the whole Bush team. You know, the whole Bush administration was completely Zionist and neocon from the get-go. And, you know, of course, Kissinger didn't want to take it because he didn't want to reveal his client list. But, you know, the fact that Bush and Cheney did not appoint a Blue Ribbon investigation on day one makes them culpable of treason because, you know, this is a huge crime. Thousands of people were killed. And this crime was committed in order to take the United States into the war on terror. That's one thing I'm talking about on my tour, is people have to understand that the war on terror construct was put together in the late 1970s when the Likud party came to power. And they had set it all up like a big bonfire, all fueled up and ready to go, and they just needed the spark to light it. And the spark that lit it was 9/11.
Right, right. Now, interestingly, there was a Fox News special, a four-part series done by Carl Cameron that exposed that 200 Israelis were arrested in connection with 9/11, and 60 of those failed polygraph tests that actually showed that they were involved. Now, can you tell me, do you remember what happened to these 200 Israelis who were arrested?
Yeah, they were all sent home on visa violations, usually. Many of them were actually experts in demolition. There's a DEA document, an investigation report that was online, it still is online, I'm sure, and it talks about these individuals by name and by location. And one of them, I think his name is Per Segalowitz, was a commander of a platoon in the Israeli military that was specialized in demolitions, and they could demolish bridges, buildings, houses, whatever you wanted, you know. And these people had been involved in trying to infiltrate DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency offices, and homes of personnel from DEA for like a year, 2 years prior to 9/11. And like, you know, on 9/11, a lot of Israelis were rounded up. Israelis were arrested in many locations, you know, with trucks with explosives in them, with trucks that blew up, with trucks that had, you know, things painted on the side. You know, these five that I told you about. So, you know, there were so many reports. I called the Israeli embassy about a week after 9/11 and asked about how many Israelis have been arrested. And I said, it appears to me that it must be like 80 or something like that. And she said, oh, yes, at least that many. So, you know, all of these people have been arrested in conjunction with 9/11. Many Israelis, hundreds of them.
You know, one thing that I do consider is that these so-called hijackers were actually, they weren't Saudi Arabian, they weren't Muslims, they were in fact Israelis posing as Muslims. Do you believe that is the case?
Bingo. You that's exactly how it works. The thing is that, you know, after 9/11, the passenger list came out, and none of these names were on the passenger list. But there were Israelis, like there was a guy, Daniel Levin from Sayeret Matkal. And you know, the initial reports were that he had been involved in the shooting on the plane, this Sayeret Matkal guy. But it's exactly as you said, the 19 Arabs and the 15 that lived in Florida, many of them had duplicate licenses issued in their name. And when you read how this happened, you know, some guy like Muhammad Atta, one of the 19, would go get a license on Wednesday, and on Thursday, the DMV would get a call from somebody claiming to be Muhammad Atta saying, yeah, I got my license yesterday, but I moved to a new apartment last night. Now, can you issue me a new license with my new address on it? And the DMV in Florida did that and mailed the new license to the new address. So you had two people using the same identity for months and months prior to 9/11. This is classic Mossad operation. It's written about in a book called The Little Drummer Girl, about how they lay a false trail. And as you say, it's very, very likely that that's exactly what we're talking about. That somebody who looked like an Arab, who spoke Arabic, but was in fact a Sephardic Jew, like a Moroccan Jew or a Tunisian Jew or whatever, a Mossad agent, was playing the role of that Arab, in quotation marks.
Now, at the moment, you're currently touring the United States doing a speaking tour. Can you tell us how that tour has been going and what have been some of the highlights?
Oh, yeah, very interesting. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was in New England until today. I just took the train across Pennsylvania, and I'm in Pittsburgh tonight. But I started out in New Hampshire, Boston, New Hampshire, and then Massachusetts and New York. And what we found is that there are gatekeepers, Jewish gatekeepers, in the 9/11 truth community who have done their utmost to prevent me from speaking. And I was supposed to speak in Greenfield, Massachusetts, for example. And we actually went through three venue changes in one day. You know, because they would threaten the owner of the theater, or they threaten the owner of this, or they would have emergency meetings and say, you know, we're getting threats from the Jewish community and from Israel that we can't let Mr. Boland speak here. And so one after another, these events were pulled. And I wound up speaking in a very nice barn west of Greenfield that day. But same thing happened in New York. The owner of the theater got threatening emails from Israel and from the local, you know, Zionist community. And so we had the event at Rudy Dent's house on Sunday. And the event in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I spoke in Cambridge, and there again, you know, the owner of the first venue turned out to be a Zionist Jew. He pulled the plug on that. And so we had it at a very nice Palestinian restaurant in downtown Cambridge. So it's been interesting,
right.
But there's been a lot of resistance because, you see, it's really ridiculous, but these people, these gatekeepers, are trying to hold back the flood of information that's now available about 9/11. And they remind me of, like, the little boy in Holland who put his finger in the dike and tried to stop the dike from, you know, the dam from breaking. The water's already over the top. And these people are really, all they're doing is showing themselves, the gatekeepers especially, as being, you know, partisan and hostile to 9/11 truth being discussed.
Have you seen over the years that people are actually waking up in larger numbers these days than before?
Oh, big time. Absolutely. Big time. Huge. I mean, you know, from 2005, you know, I was writing about this from the very beginning practically. I mean, back in September 2001, I wrote articles about it because it was my profession. It was my job, and I was very intrigued by what happened on 9/11. But I was like one hand clapping about this Israeli involvement thesis. You know, it developed slowly over time, but I was like the only person talking about it, and there was no resonance in the community. But things have changed greatly. People are now very keenly aware of what false flag terrorism means. So when they look at something like what just happened at the airport in Istanbul, Turkey, or what happened in Orlando a couple weeks ago, Americans are much more aware of the possibility that a terror attack can be a false flag operation. And the supporters of my thesis have a great following now. There's a lot of people who understand this and are convinced that Israel was the key mover, the prime mover of the 9/11 atrocity.
Yes, sir. And when people call me a conspiracy theorist, I like to point out, well, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy factist. I only deal with facts. Do you contend with that?
No, I agree. I agree absolutely because I'm not a theorist at all as well. It's not theory. In the very beginning, it was a hypothesis. You know, I worked from the position that this was a hypothesis, that this could have very well have been an Israeli false flag operation. Because there were very early and solid indications that it was so. like the Odigo message that I was talking about, those five dancing Israelis, and many others, and the Israeli spy students or whatever, art students. So I'm starting with that as a hypothesis that it's possible, that it was possible that this was an Israeli false flag operation. I worked from that hypothesis. But then as time went on, and as the consistency became 100%, where I found in every single key position in this saga that you have an Israeli agent or you have an Israeli themselves, Israeli intelligence, and that these people are connected to each other. They're not just like character A, B, and C. There are people who are all connected to each other. So I said, there's no question that this is the network behind it. And you know what's really telling is when you look at the people who were involved in the cover-up. Because the crime of 9/11, you know, solving that is going to require still some more information coming forward, like who actually put the thermite, the nanothermite in the building, how did they do it? But the cover-up is most transparent. The cover-up is as transparent as the window in your house. So you can see exactly who's involved in the cover-up, who's done what, and they are all connected to the culprits. Because in such a crime, the cover-up is the most important part of the crime. Because in order to get the war on terror, in order to get us involved in the war on terror, they had to promote this cover-up. That's why it was so essential.
We have a question from a listener, Winston Smith in Hawaii, would like to know, Mr. Berlin, do you still support the idea that a DU or depleted uranium missile was part of the attack mechanism on the South Tower?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There, in my presentation, I show some slides, you know, and there's this one slide, a very good slide, that shows just before the plane strikes the South Tower, there's a huge white-hot hole, which is about the size of the fuselage of the plane. And it's white hot. And this is indicative of a DU warhead penetrating that facade. And now you see this missile would play several roles. First of all, a DU warhead is pyrophoric. It's burning in the air. And when it strikes a surface like the outside of the tower, it gets even hotter. And it's white hot. And this is when it goes through that floor, when it penetrated and went through the floor of that tower, it was creating a superheated environment in which anything combustible combusted. So this is what, of course, led to the spectacular combustion of the jet fuel. But also, it apparently combusted a lot of thermite packages that had been put there. And as we know, that particular floor in the South Tower was the computer floor of Fuji Bank. And an employee from Fuji Bank told me that in the summer prior to 9/11, at night, large black boxes were brought onto that floor into the computer center, computer room, you know, without people. And they were told that these were backup battery units for the computer operations. But he said, you know, the strange thing was they were never plugged in. Now, I think that these were the large black boxes that contained large amounts of thermite or thermate, and that provided a lot of spectacular explosion, but also what caused the cascade of molten iron that fell from the World Trade Center, from that floor, for about 7 minutes before the collapse. Molten iron poured off the 81st floor for 7 minutes. Tons of it. Well, how'd you get the tons in there? Well, they probably were in those battery units, or so-called battery units. But now another thing is that by that when that DU warhead went into that floor and combusted all that stuff, and thermite packages were exploded, that also was very useful in destroying the aircraft itself, so that very little of the aircraft was existing as
right.
Afterwards as any sort of evidence, and they destroyed it all.
I do know that you've met with the former German minister, Andreas von Bülow. What does he consider your work as? Does he enjoy and contend with your work?
Yeah, well, I met him first in December or late November of 2001 when I moved to Germany, because I thought that it was safer to be there, more prudent to be in Germany than in America when the country was going to war based on this lie, and I was writing about the pack of lies. So Andreas von Bülow met me, and we spent a whole afternoon at his house, and I even asked him who do you think was behind it? And he thought he said the Mossad. And I reported what he said in my article that I wrote, and he was surprised, a little bit shocked and surprised that they had been published, because he told every German journalist exactly the same thing, but it was never printed in Germany. His statement that he thought Mossad was behind it was never printed in Germany, but in my newspaper, wow, American Free Press, they printed it. But he also talked about how these, you know, false flag terrorism operations work. The management, architectural level, working level, deception, and how the CIA creates a accepted version of events that is promoted in the mainstream, in the controlled media, and which people just, you know, take home and believe. And he says journalists who differ from that script are seen as crazy, like me. You know.
We have a question from Harold in Virginia. What do you think of Richard Gage and his group of architects and engineers seeking to expose the truth of 9/11?
Oh, they're great. They're great. Richard Gage has done fantastic work, and architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth have done fantastic work because, you see, we're dealing with public opinion, and the mainstream media has only promoted the lies about 9/11. They've only promoted the false narrative and the war on terror as being the natural sort of, corollary to war on 9/11. And Richard Gage has done a fantastic job of educating the American people that the government explanation for what happened to the Twin Towers and other buildings cannot possibly be true. And this is backed up by some 2,500 architects and engineers who design and build such structures. And if these people are saying that this can't possibly be true, it deserves to be heard. And this has been a great educational device, a great educational tool for the American people. And because I talk about the political side. I talk about who did it and why they did it, whereas Richard Gage and architects and engineers explain that it cannot possibly be that the government version we've been given is correct. Of course it's not correct.
Do you personally think that 9/11 was done for the war on terror or for multiple reasons? Do you think it was done by Israel to get sympathy for their situation to attack the Palestinians more?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, it was fundamentally the main long-term planning was the former. Yes, it was done in order to kickstart the war on terror. As I said, the war on terror as an Israeli construct, as an Israeli ideology, a strategy, was first promoted on the world stage at the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism in July 1979. And George Herbert Walker Bush spoke at the final session. And this was a conference that was hosted by Menachem Begin from the Likud party and the younger Bibi Netanyahu, the current Prime Minister of Israel, and his father, and their cronies. And they got all this world media to come to them, you know, the world journalists to come to their conference, and political leaders from the United States and other countries, and they unearthed the scheme that basically said, the doctrine that said that the United States should bring its military into the Middle East to wage war against these Islamic groups that were threatening Israel. And they did this, of course. They say that this is because Islamic terrorists plague Israel because it's a Western nation. So we're all in this together, so we all have to help each other out. This is the basics, you know, the real basics of the war on terror thing. And then Netanyahu spent like the next 10 years pushing this doctrine, this ideology, with books and articles and speeches. But it wasn't starting. It was like trying to light a forest fire in the pouring rain. It wasn't lighting. And I read his book, like in 1986, I read his book, Fighting Terrorism, How the West Can Win. And I said, you know, he wants America and the West to come and fight those enemies of Israel, I thought, but how are they going to do this? I mean, it's not going to happen. We're not going to just send our troops over there, you know, like we did in Lebanon in 82, just to see them get killed and participate in Israel's war. They needed something to make it real. And so they had all these kind of ideas, these think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Catastrophic Terrorism Study Group and PNAC, and they set this whole construction up, and then finally 9/11 happened, and that kickstarted the whole war on terror, but as you said, there are other crimes involved. It's like a crime within a crime within a crime. So the war on terror is the essence of it. But there were many other crimes committed that day. There was a destruction of evidence in Building 6 when somebody broke into the vault and cleaned out the vault the night before from the U.S. Customs House, Building 6. There was, of course, huge gold heists going on. Gold was stolen, you know, all across the World Trade Center complex. And what's interesting is that, like, this was all being done by people who were in the know, people who knew that the World Trade Center was going to go down on September 11th at 8:45 in the morning. And so they said, well, I can go there and do this. I can get this. We can get this. And so they committed many, many, many crimes. And so it's a crime within a crime within a crime.
We have a question from Carol in Glendalow who would like to know, do you think the politicians do not speak out because they're being blackmailed or threatened by the Samson option?
Well, it could be the Samson option. I think that's the least of their concerns. A lot of these politicians, like I'm from Chicago, Illinois originally, and the Speaker of the House at the time when George Bush declared war on terror was a guy named Dennis Hastert. And this is like a guy who was his claim to fame prior to going to Congress was he was a wrestling coach at a high school in Southern Illinois. And I said to myself, wait a minute, how does this guy, he's a wrestling coach, how did he become Speaker of the House? Well, he became Speaker of the House because he was also a serial pedophile. And he had molested young men back in Illinois when he was a high school coach. And so, you know, somebody said, this guy, we can use this guy. There are many people in Congress like that who have skeletons in the closet and vices that are known to a few, and those few control those people. The Samson option is not the thing that scares American politicians. The exposure of their vices and their crimes is what concerns them. I mean, we're dealing in a situation now, you know, the Clinton family has a long criminal record in this country. The Bush family has a very long criminal record in this country. And on and on and on. And so it's like nothing binds people more closely together than a crime committed together. And in the case of the Clintons and the Bushes and the Israelis, the big crime that they committed together was Iran-Contra. Iran-Contra and the drug smuggling to the United States and the weapons going to Iran and all that stuff. They have been involved in this stuff for a long time, going back to the 70s.
We got a question here from a person here in Australia who would like to know, oh, actually, it's Frank in Missouri, I beg your pardon, who would like to know, have you ever had any personal harassment or has your family been harassed since doing 9/11 research?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, I was attacked by undercover police at my home in August 2006, and then I was prosecuted by this local police force. The attack squad, the three-man attack squad, was led by a person who was an officer for Homeland Security. He has two jobs. He's a local cop, and at the same time, he's a Homeland Security guy. And then when we were forced to go to Europe, I lived in Europe for the last 7 years, 8 years. There, I was being surveilled and eavesdropped. Gang stalked. I was being stalked by a three-man team. One was in California, one was in Italy, and one was in Sweden. And, you know, harassed by these people. And you know, you don't get any protection from the authorities. You know, because even in Sweden, I've been defamed. And when I try to use the defamation law in my defense, they say, no, they have a right to call you whatever they want to call you. And likewise, They didn't prosecute this person who stalked and came into the house behind my daughter. They didn't prosecute that person. They let him go back to Italy. So it's like, you know, and in Chicago, when I was attacked by undercover police, the cops lied on the stand. My evidence was thrown out. My expert witness was not allowed to testify. And the videotapes were destroyed by the police, and they still won their case. So it's like, you just got to take care of yourself.
We have a question here from Paul Joseph Watson in Birmingham, UK. Have you heard of the corporation called the Carlyle Group, and do you believe that they had something to do with it?
Well, the Carlyle Group is they are at the funding operation. There are these, just like the Carlyle Group, yes, and the Blackstone Group, yes, and all these big corporations. There's a lot of connections of those people to ownership of companies and properties involved. But the thing is that when you look at 9/11, You have to understand that it was a heinous atrocity, and that it was done by a very small group of people. And the actual architects and managers of the crime are very tightly connected. They do not just, you know, share corporate boards. They share a common ideology and a common ethnicity and a common nationality, and that is the Israeli. So these characters have branches into, as you said, you know, these companies like Carlyle, what have you. But the real connection is that they have a devotion to this ideology of protecting the state of Israel and advancing the Zionist agenda. Not all of them are Israelis. I mean, like, there's the Rothschild family, and there's people like that who are Zionists but don't live in Israel. But they are absolutely, you know, key components, key supporters of the state of Israel.
What, in your opinion, is the biggest danger we're facing in the world today?
Oh, the biggest danger is that we're on the verge of a terrible war in the Middle East and also involving Russia. I mean, the America's participation in the war in Syria is extremely criminal and extremely ill-advised. And so, you know, this is a situation that brings us into basically a loggerheads with the Soviet Union, with Russia, and with Iran. And so that, you know, it's like the United States and Israel are trying to cut away at the supporting allies of Iran and Russia. And Syria, they thought, would be the best place to do it. But, you know, it's a terrible catastrophe. And this war in Syria would end tomorrow if the United States decided that would be so. That war has been promoted and fomented, you know, by the United States, by our CIA, and by people like John Forbes Kerry and Barack Obama. I mean, when you listen to John Forbes Kerry talk, Secretary of State Kerry, when you listen to him talk about the war in Syria, he said on May 3rd, he said, you know, as long as Assad is in power, this war goes on. Well, who's he talking for? He's speaking for his proxy forces, which he controls.
We have a question here from Forever Mike in Liverpool, who would like to know, have you ever been approached by the CIA or asked to join them in their ranks?
No, I've never been approached by anybody from the CIA, but I have been approached. I have been, when I was in Germany back in the fall of 2001, I got a woman who was a former asset or an agent of Stasi, that's East German intelligence, and who admitted on her own that she was also working for Mossad. She approached me through another friend, and she tried to sell me the story about the beam weapon breaking down the World Trade Center and pulverizing it, which was a bunch of hooey. But I mean, this is the essence of what Judy Woods writes about. And so I wrote another little article about it, but I could see that this was kind of like fantasy, and so I didn't include it in the final book. But no, nobody from the CIA has ever approached me. They don't have any interest in me. Certainly don't want to hire me. They don't donate either.
Have you had anybody contact you confidentially with sort of whistleblower information about 9/11?
A little bit. I mean, yeah, some confidential people who like one guy in Florida. He was a Russian immigrant who was involved in this art business and you know, these imprints, these things that you iron on shirts and things like that. And he sent me an email, and people like that, he told me about how he had come across this company, which was an Israeli front company pretending to be a Muslim company, that was involved with all those art students and all that stuff. And I think the article is called The Florida Connection. But you know, and people that see that I'm investigating this crime have come forward and given me information. And then you got to be careful, because sometimes the people are actually throwing you a curveball. Like, you know, there was a guy, Sam Danner, way back when, who claimed to have been at the pickup of the involved in the cleaning up of the Pentagon, but apparently was a liar. And so, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt. You have to find out if these people are actually telling the truth or not. And
I do remember that. Samuel Danner claimed he was an eyewitness at the Pentagon. I remember when that story broke. Yeah, it was kind of big. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know about?
Go ahead.
No. After you.
Well, yeah, he claimed to have been at the Pentagon when he wasn't, and he claimed to have been involved in the pickup of the debris on the lawn, which I don't think he was. And he's just a strange character, you know. And so when you're a journalist and people tell you things like that, especially in such a thing like this, you know, you have to put all those caveats in there, like if what he says is true, because you can't confirm it. You know, it's really hard to confirm it. But then what happened in the Sam Danner case, I think it was his son. His son came forward and said, "My dad's lying."
Wow. So, are you aware of the research done by Dmitry Kalazov and his contention that 40 megaton nukes were used in the basements of these buildings?
Yeah, I've heard the story. I've seen the videos where he talks about that. I don't know who this guy is. I mean, because, you know, I can't find out where he is from or what his background is or anything. He appeared on some TV program or something and talked about that. But, the evidence isn't there. It's... there may have been dirty bombs used. I mean, like, we're talking about a very sophisticated operation. So, I mean, to strap some, nuclear material onto a conventional bomb of some sort and blend it in with the whole mess is possible. But, the idea that the World Trade Center was destroyed by a nuclear blast, either a large one or a series of small ones, is not supported by the evidence.
How about the missing gold bullion from underneath the towers? Do you know much about that at all?
I don't know anything about it. I mean, I know that there was a great deal of gold being moved around. There were convoys. There was one abandoned convoy, I think, between building 4 and 5. A truck, you know, they have underground tunnels, and there were trucks full of gold and stuff. So obviously people were ripping it off. And some people who were at the World Trade Center prior to 9/11, and they told me that they had seen a lot of Moishe's moving vans around the World Trade Center in the days and weeks prior to 9/11. And Moishe's is interesting because it's a Mossad operation. They have a big, gigantic fortress-like building that takes up a whole city block just on the other side of the Holland Tunnel. So when you come out of the World Trade Center and you go a couple blocks away, you enter the Holland Tunnel, and you go through the Holland Tunnel, which is like just maybe a quarter mile, and you come out the other side of the river, and there it is, Moishe's moving. And I wrote an article about that because I tend to think that the Moishe's moving played a role in the logistics and in the removal of the loot. I think I call it, the loot was taken to Moishe's. I think that's very much the case. I visited Moishe's once before, and the whole place was staffed by a bunch of young Israeli men. And I talked to some of them. I said, like, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, do you got green cards and stuff? And no, they don't know green cards. And I said, you know, how'd you get the job? And they, we got the job in Israel. I go, like, holy cow. So I think that Moishe's moving serves as a logistics base. Because, when you're a foreign company, a foreign country running operations in the United States, you need a whole logistics network. You need places to store stuff. You need transportation networks. You know, you need places to move the drugs in and out. You know, it's a big criminal operation, what the Israelis are doing in the United States. And it's been going on for a long time.
And they're still continuing today with their influence in both the Senate and the Congress and in all these lobby groups. Do you believe that's a danger to America?
Oh, is it a danger? It's the reason why I've been writing about this stuff for like the last 30 years. Absolutely, it's a danger. It's like a complete erosion of our integrity, of our everything. And Israel has been a threat to this nation since 1948. I mean, they've committed false flag terror attacks since the early 50s. They attacked USS Liberty in 1967. And you see, I saw this. I've lived in Israel. I know how they operate. I know how they think. I know what they're doing in this country. I mean, I just see the tip of the iceberg. And I say, this is very detrimental to my nation. And so that when 9/11 happened, and when I put the pieces together in the puzzle, it's like, this is what they do. This is what they do. And that's why it's so important that we undeceive ourselves about 9/11 and the war on terror. Because if we don't, we will be enslaved to the Zionist war agenda, which will destroy us.
So apart from Andreas von Bülow, have you had any other politicians talk to you about your views on 9/11?
Well, Andreas von Bülow was a retired parliamentarian. I spoke to two other former German intelligence guys, Eckhard Bertebach, and the third man, I forgot his name off the top of my head. And I've spoken to, some politicians, but nobody too big. You know, not that I can recall. I mean, in my years of writing and stuff, I contact people like Michael Chertoff, and I contacted the former head of the CIA. I mean, I call those people up, but not politicians. Oh, I did write an open letter to Trump, but I didn't get a response. And I also wrote an open letter to the Pope, but I didn't get a response. But I basically, I'm trying to emphasize on these people who want to be political leaders in this country and in the world, that you have to address 9/11 truth. And for the Pope, for example, not to address 9/11 truth says a lot. It says a lot about his integrity. Because the world has been taken into war after war after war. Millions of people have been killed. Millions of people have been displaced. And nobody's talking any truth about it.
I have heard over the years that there are some celebrities as well, for example, Bruce Willis and Woody Harrelson, that all know about 9/11, but they're just too scared to talk about it in public. Do you think that's the case with a lot of people, that they know about it, but they just don't want to destroy their own credibility or career?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because in the United States, you know, it's basically, it's unfortunately a very individualistic country, every man for himself. You know, and people feel very vulnerable, especially when they've got a lot of money and a lot of value in their career, like a Hollywood star or a singer. And so, unfortunately, what we find is that these people do not come forward and say something until they've retired and got their money put away nice and safely. One person who's speaking out pretty well about at least the boycott movement is the former singer from Pink Floyd. But, you know, he's kind of trying to influence other singers to boycott Israel and what have you. But 9/11 truth is really still, unfortunately, a bridge too far for many people to go to. They won't cross that because they don't want to lose the security that they have. They're afraid. They're afraid. I can understand that.
Absolutely. And thank you for mentioning Roger Waters. He does a fantastic job with BDS and waking people up to the apartheid state of Israel.
Right. Right, and I'm trying to get a book to him, but I don't know how to get it to him because you know these people are hard to reach, you know, and I don't know.
I do know that. I've been trying for about a year to get him on the show, but apparently he's just too busy.
No, he's not too busy, but you should keep trying because you know, contact his former wife in Long Island or something like that, and you might very well get a positive response because he does want to talk about these things, and the mainstream media is not letting him talk. So I would definitely encourage you to try to get him on your show.
What is possibly the most memorable experience you've had over the years in the work you have done thus far?
Oh gosh, that's a big question. I don't know. There's so many, you know, and I've been working on it for so long, and it's been an effort that's spanned continents. I mean, I started working, of course, in the United States, and then over in Europe, and then up in Germany and Scandinavia, and all over. And I can't think of anything that's particularly, I've spoken in a lot of places. I think one thing that was quite memorable and quite positive was the European Truth Tour that we went on back in 2005. Jimmy Walter took us on a bunch of 9/11 truth people, some who were more truthful than others, and we went around Europe and spoke in capital cities all across Europe. I thought that was pretty good because I was the only person, of course, on the tour who had the belief or the thesis that we're talking about now. I'm the only person to talk about that. And so, I don't know. Now it seems that the evidence is pretty clear that my thesis is, in fact, valid.
Your current tour that you're doing in the United States, can you tell us, how has that been? Have you got a lot of positive feedback from people, and are they interested?
Oh, yeah. It's very good, and it seems, though, that I'm really speaking to leaders. You know, the people that come to these events, especially after they've been thwarted, when the event goes through several venue changes like it did in Greenfield, the people that come to the event are really leaders. They're people who are understand this stuff. They have something to add to the conversation. They know a lot, and they want to do something. And so it's like it's not just anybody. That's very good, because we need to reach out and spread the information in our communities so that more and more people become aware of this. Because, you see, the war on terror, as I have to repeat this, the war on terror was the reason for 9/11. And, you know, 9/11 was an atrocity. Thousands of people were killed. But what's worse than that is that we have been involved in this criminal war for the past 15 years. And we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars every day fighting a war in which there is no legitimate U.S. interest at all. And this is what is demoralizing our nation and destroying. We've destroyed like a half a dozen countries. We've left like a half a dozen countries like roadkill. I mean, this is obscene, and it's dangerous, and it's demoralizing, and it cannot go on. And the political predicament that we're in right now is that of these political candidates who are running for high office in this country, not a single one of them are calling for 9/11 truth, and none of them are calling for an end to the war on terror. So how do we get out of it? That's our predicament.
Yeah, I understand that. Have you had anybody at these speaking tours that have come up to you at the end and said, my God, you've blown my mind. You've totally turned me around 180 degrees. Has there been anyone that's really thanked you completely stunned by what you've been saying?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That happens every time. That happens every time. People are just blown away by the information. And they like this presentation a lot, the one that I'm doing now. And it seems to be, I seem to be hitting all the nails on the head very well, and they find it absolutely compelling. And they just, yeah, they're floored. They're floored by it. So that's one reason why it's getting a lot of flack, especially, I think, in areas where there's a large Jewish audience. Because, you know, these Zionist gatekeepers do not want American Jews to hear this message. Because they want to keep American Jews kind of like a captive audience, as a captive crowd, and if they hear what I say, they're going to realize that you know Israel and the Likud government that runs Israel is not at all a friend of the Jewish people.
One thing that I've considered over the years is that the average Joe just doesn't have the 9-to-5 job that he's working with all the bills he's paying and the family he's trying to feed, just doesn't have the time to read the volumes and volumes of information that you have to get to find some of this truth. Do you think that's one of the problems, that we just don't have time these days to actually sit down and study this stuff like you have?
Oh, that's certainly the problem. But, I mean, people don't have to spend the 12, 15 years that I've spent. You know, it's been a huge job for me. It's been a long, long, long struggle. But they can read my book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, is a small book, in which the whole thesis is laid out in about 13 or 14 chapters. It's a very readable book, very nice, very easy on the eye, wide margins, and 360 pages. And that's a great book to start with, because when you read that, they will understand this whole thesis in its entirety. And then if they want to know more, then the second book is the companion volume, is Solving 9/11, the original articles, which contains all my articles written from September 2001 through to April or May 2012. And that's like the mother load of information. Those are the detailed research articles with all the information that underpin the thesis. And so those two books together, I sell them at my presentations or to read people who want to get them for $40, and with $40 and with about 720 pages total of reading material, they've got it all there in front of them, and so you know, but you have to read. You know, you can't expect to understand 9/11 truth simply by watching a video of 50 minutes or so. You know, I'm trying to present 50 years of research in a presentation of an hour. So I can only hit the main points and show them the compelling evidence that my thesis is correct.
And I think that's probably the biggest challenge, is summarizing all those years of information into something that's digestible, readable, and at the same time very educatable, very enlightening, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's compelling. You know, so I show them, the main thing that I'm showing them in the presentation now is the background of the war on terror, and that the war on terror is a solid Israeli, exclusive Israeli construct. That's like a, something that you create in the mind, an ideology that you create. And so this whole idea of the war on terror was, composed and developed by Mossad, by Israeli intelligence. And is military intelligence, and then they created, then they had to create, when they created the construct, they had to create the bad guy. And I show them exactly how Israeli military intelligence under Ehud Barak trained Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, and trained the most anti-Western faction, which then became Al-Qaeda, and is now ISIS. So the whole thing is an Israeli operation from A to Z. And when you understand that, and when you see the names and the connections that I show in this presentation, it's compelling. There's nothing else to talk about. And so then we have a very serious problem. You know, what do we do with the state of Israel? Well, I mean, I think the first thing you do is you boycott it, and divest from it, and give it the same treatment that they gave to other countries that were so deemed to be, outlaw states, like I think South Africa was one. And, we simply have to disengage from the Zionist operation and put it out of business.
I have seen some articles online, some disturbing articles, where people have attacked your wife as being some sort of Israeli agent. Can you dispel that right now for the audience, please?
Yeah. Well, my wife is Estonian. She's not, she's an Estonian, grew up in Estonia, lives in Sweden. And I think that there's a lot of slander about me in libelous articles. They're pure rubbish. One of them was written by a former colleague of mine at American Free Press, who passed away. But this is also very telling, that anybody would go to such lengths to try to slander me, or my family, is indicative that they're desperate. They're trying to slander and libel the messenger because of the message. If I were talking a bunch of rubbish, if I were just blowing hot air, they wouldn't give a damn. But because I am actually directly over the target, I get a lot of flack.
And that's probably a sure sign that you're onto something, that you're actually onto the truth when you do get that flack.
Oh, absolutely. They wouldn't do it otherwise. And, what really happened in 2006 was we made solid discoveries, scientific discoveries, that indicated that thermite was involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And then that later, resulted in the peer-reviewed paper by Stephen Jones, that a nano composite of thermite was used, and they actually have evidence of that nano composite of thermite. And this was a discovery that was not supposed to happen. And when it did happen, that's when we were attacked. And then the next year, Judy Wood's book came out talking about, energy beam weapons being used to break down the World Trade Center. Because, they needed to try to attack this discovery because it was not supposed to happen. That was a discovery. The discovery of thermite, nanothermite, was not supposed to happen.
So in your opinion, a lot of these truth seekers that come out with these stories and these ideas and hypotheses, that's just, a lot of them is just to muddy the water, do you believe?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, come on. That's how disinformation works. Of course, Judy Wood is a good example. Judy Wood, in her book, in the introduction, in the beginning, in the middle, and the end, she says that the destruction of the World Trade Center, the demolition of the World Trade Center, she says was a cold event. Well, in the dust of the World Trade Center, you have billions of tiny droplets of molten iron, and you have a tiny droplets of molten molybdenum. And molten molybdenum has a melting temperature of about 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. These two things, these two bits of information, of evidence, indicate that the destruction of the World Trade Center was, in fact, an extremely hot event. I call it an American Holocaust, because the people who are trapped above the zones of impact, the poor people who are trapped above in those upper parts of the tower, were literally cooked alive.
Isn't it true that Marvin Bush, the brother of the president George W. Bush, otherwise known as Baby Bush or Chimpy Bush, do you believe that he was actually involved in the security of the World Trade Centers?
No. He had been on the board of directors of something called Stratasec, and Stratasec had some minor role in providing security equipment in 1996, 1997, and 1998. And in 1998, they were actually, basically relieved, fired from the operation, no longer, contributing to anything to security. The security company that you have to look at for the World Trade Center was something called Kroll Associates. That's Jules Kroll's company. That is the company that got the contract for the World Trade Center security in 1993 after the first bombing, and they maintained their control all the way through. And like they had hired John O'Neill, who died on 9/11, for example, the guy who investigated Al-Qaeda, FBI man. And they were the ones who the first plane went into a related company's computer room. The first plane went into Marsh McLennan corporate company. That's Maurice Greenberg and Jules Kroll. That's their company, one of their companies. And Maurice Greenberg, his son, was the CEO of that company where the first plane went into. Both planes went into secure computer rooms. That's important to understand, too, because the computer rooms were, played a key role in the whole operation.
Giuliani's head of emergency management, Jerome Hauer, what role do you think he played in this whole event?
Right. Well, Jerome Hauer was also a member of Kroll Associates. He was a former employee of Kroll Associates. He was in San Diego that morning, but he had been the director of Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. And he had overseen the placement of the OEM bunker, the hardened bunker, on the 23rd floor of Building 7. And on that day, the usual people were not in that bunker, but other people were. And I think that that bunker was probably established in that high-rise tower belonging to Mr. Silverstein in order to be used in the destruction of the World Trade Center. Because it's like when you destroy a building, when you pull a big operation like that, when you want to destroy the biggest towers in the world, you have to have people within eyesight making all the decisions and pushing the buttons and pulling the levers in order to bring the building down. It's a fairly complex operation. You can't do it from Tel Aviv or Afghanistan.
So they use the emergency bunker as some sort of control room?
Oh yes, I believe so. Yes. There were strange going-ons in that building, Building 7, on 9/11. Absolutely.
And indeed, there was a lot of evidence that was going to be brought to court in the Enron collapse, and actually George W. Bush was going to be called into court to answer for those frauds. But they couldn't have that court when all the evidence was destroyed in Building 7.
Exactly. And the evidence was destroyed in Building 7, and also in Building 6, in the Customs House, there was somebody went into that vault the night before and cleaned it out. The vault, the evidence vault, which was for Building 7 and Building 6, was in the basement of Building 6. And that vault had been cleaned out the night before. So that's what I'm saying, that this is a crime within a crime within a crime. And part of the 9/11 crime was confiscating and destroying evidence in these huge crimes like Enron, WorldCom, and big financial crimes like gold scandals and things like that. There was all kinds of money that was due and securities that were due and huge payments that were made, $200 billion here and there. And all that stuff had to be basically pushed under the carpet. And that's what 9/11 did.
And of course, at the Pentagon, the guy who was in charge of the defense of the Pentagon, General Montague Winfield, put Captain Charles Lediger in charge that morning. Do you know what happened to him after 9/11?
No. No, I don't.
Oh, he was personally promoted by George Bush to be an admiral from a captain.
U.S. Navy.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it seems all the main supporters, all the main people, they all got promotions instead of being told off for a failure.
Yeah, There was also, of course, this NORAD scenario that was going on that day, Operation Vigilant Guardian or something like that. They were doing several operations, which were very, very confusing for the people that were working at the at NEADS in Rome, New York, the Northeast Air Defense Sector, the people that oversee the military response and with FAA. They were confused by these computer games that were going on, so they didn't know, you know, what they were looking at on their screens, because the game was going on, and because the game involved putting false inputs on the screen, injects, they didn't know when it actually happened, and they got a call, and somebody said, you know, we've got a hijacked plane. Their first response is, well, is this real, or is this part of the game? Is this a drill? And so this confusion was prevailed on 9/11, and NORAD, you know, NORAD is North American, you know, Air Defense Section with Canada. They lied completely to the 9/11 Commission and the American people and the government about what was going on. And, that's why these people, maybe that man you mentioned before, but also the men that were running NORAD, two of whom were Canadians, they need to be prosecuted or at least investigated for their crimes. But the real problem is that 9/11 was never investigated. 9/11 was not treated as a crime. It was treated as an act of war. And so rather than investigate the crime, they simply destroyed the evidence.
And of course, there was a terrorism drill, the bioterrorism drill on September 11th that was planned for that, called Tripod 2. Are you aware of that one at all?
Was that the one in New York City?
Yes, that's correct. That apparently FEMA turned up the day before.
Yeah. And that's the one that resulted in the men, the people who should have been in the emergency bunker on the 23rd floor of Building 7, being relocated down to a pier, like Pier 44 or something.
So yes, that's right.
So that the usual crew of people who would have been in that bunker were not there that day. It was a very, very complex crime, and there were layers upon layers. Like I said, so they had these various drills going on. And people were involved, and people were taken out of the picture. Some people were like, who should have been, as you said, should have been at their desk that day, were down in Puerto Rico or something, you know. So this is amazing that so many people who should have been at work that day were not at work. And the planes that were flown down from Otis Air Force Base that should have been in New York City, but they were diverted over the ocean. Now what were they doing? What were they diverted over the ocean for? And who did that?
And, of course, we can't have a 9/11 discussion without talking that the main guy that they blamed, Osama bin Laden, who planned all this from a cell phone in a cave on a dialysis machine.
Yeah, it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. You know, he had, you know, this operation was so far, so sophisticated. It was like the former director of counterterrorism for the State Department said, we've never seen anything like this. He said, it's the only thing that comes close is a Soviet intelligence operation. This was extremely complicated, very advanced, planned over decades, and that's another thing that I show in the in my presentation. I show how the Israelis, Israeli Mossad, Israeli intelligence agents have been talking about and pushing this idea of airplanes flying into the World Trade Center, making movies about it, putting the idea out there. You know, it's so obvious that this is an Israeli crime. People are living in denial to think otherwise.
Yes, indeed. That's the aspect of pre-planned cognitive, what's it called? Pre-planned programming of these ideas that are put in and seeded into shows like The Lone Gunman for The X-Files and shown to people to get them familiar with the idea.
Yes. And some people say that there's even this idea that by putting it out there, by showing it very clearly what they intend to do, that somehow this is some sort of way to lessen their karmic debt. I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, these people have some pretty weird beliefs. But clearly, the people that did 9/11, that masterminded and carried out 9/11, are evil incarnate, and there's no reason why we should have any pity for them. Whatever their ethnicity is, whatever their ideology is, these people have to be booked and you know, interrogated, and the whole network has to be uprooted. wherever it is.
One of the most prevalent arguments I get from 9/11 truth deniers is it would have taken thousands and thousands of people to plan something like this, and why hasn't anyone spoken up? What do you say to that?
Well, it doesn't take thousands and thousands. It doesn't take thousands and thousands at all. It takes, I can't estimate how many, but it's a much smaller group than that, because what Israelis learned way back in the Lavon affair in Egypt, when that was exposed by one of the agents that was arrested, they said that from now on they have to compartmentalize the operations so that people only know what they need to know, need to know basis. And furthermore, what Mossad learned in the United States is that they operate all kinds of companies that serve the purpose, in providing what they need. So that, like, you have people like Ehud Barak, who came over to the United States a year before 9/11, and he was working and living in Philadelphia and New Jersey. And one of the companies that he worked with actually made, atomized aluminum, which can be used in making, he worked in a company that made the components of nanothermite. And, I mean, there's not very many companies that make that kind of stuff, especially back in 2001. The nanothermite, nanocomposites of thermite, and these energetic materials are very, very sophisticated. And they're made in laboratories like Lawrence Livermore Lab and places like that, and very advanced college campuses that are devoted to nanotechnology. And so, that's the kind of stuff that was made, and that's what was used in the World Trade Center.
And, of course, those kind of materials are only accessible by somebody within the military departments. So what you're suggesting is that it didn't take thousands of people. It just took key people in key strategic positions.
Exactly. Exactly right. And it's like there's a Stanford Research Institute in California, Menlo Park, California. It used to be part of Stanford. It's now it's a research and development for the U.S. military. And they make nanothermite. They make these composites, these energetic composites. And the guy that runs the laboratory there, in Menlo Park, is an Israeli fellow, an Israeli citizen, and he's been there since 1984. And the Jewish guy who oversaw the NIST report on the destruction of the World Trade Center. This is the report that came out in 2005, the final report on the collapse of the World Trade Center. After he finished that report and did the cover up, he then later went to work and became executive director of CEO of this company that makes nanothermite in Menlo Park, California.
Wow.
It's like, these are the people who didn't see, who saw no explosions on 9/11, who saw no molten metal, who ridiculed the idea that there was molten metal at the World Trade Center. They ridicule it. When it was seen by the firefighters, it's been photographed on film, it's been seen on television, it was found by the people that removed the rubble. Oh, molten metal was everywhere at the World Trade Center, but they didn't see it. It's in, for crying out loud, it's at least 6% of the dust of the World Trade Center is molten iron.
One thing I do hear from a lot of deniers is, it's 2016, that was so long ago, just get over it, stop talking about it. Why do you think it is important for us to never forget this and keep talking about it and keep bringing it up in discussion?
Because it's a seminal event of our time. 9/11 is the event, as I said, that kickstarted, that brought into reality this war on terror. Now, I understand that these people died, 3,000 people died 15 years ago, and that is in the past. But the crime and the cover-up of the crime is ongoing. And that's very important to understand. It's like the murder of John F. Kennedy. As long as the government and the media are covering up the truth of 9/11, it means that our government and our media are controlled by the people who carried out 9/11. And that is a pretty dire position that we are in. And that's why nothing works in this country, because this country, our country, the United States, is currently being governed by a crimocracy, a government of criminals, by criminals, and for criminals. And the upcoming election doesn't look very much better.
And of course, those people who did do this and have done this to us continue to do so, all these other false flags, like the Orlando gun event just recently. Do you believe that?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. These are like, as I said, they've constructed this bonfire, and the bonfire is now raging. Since 9/11, the bonfire has been raging. And so that you know, they just throw another log on, you know, the Bali bombing down in Indonesia, and the Madrid bombing, and the bombing, July 7th bombing in London. And then after one, it's like they're throwing logs on the fire. They say, well, the fire's getting a little low in this aspect. Throw a log on there. You know, throw a log here. And that's what they're doing. They're just feeding the fire. Now, that fire is consuming a hell of a lot of American money and lives, and it's destroying a lot of people's lives around the nation, around the world. And if we don't stop being enslaved to this logic of war, which is completely and utterly fraudulent, it will destroy this nation. You know, the Soviet Union was a powerful nation. It fell over the obstacles in Afghanistan. You know, it was their neighbor country. They were much closer. There was much less money being spent, but it destroyed. It took the bread off their tables. What do you think the war on terror is doing for American lives? It's taking the bread off our tables too. We have no endless supply of bread. We have no endless supply of butter. We have no endless supply of money. All the money that's being spent on the war on terror is being borrowed. It's borrowed money. It's money that's being borrowed off the good name of the American people. And if the American people don't stand up and stop this nonsense, it will destroy us. This is not a game. This is not something academic. This is reality.
And the lives of our children are going to be affected in the future by all of this.
Oh, totally, totally, totally. I mean, you know, you look around America today and you see, you don't look very far to see the neglected infrastructure and the poverty and the joblessness and the homelessness. These are all directly related to this nonsense war on terror that is just like eating up all the assets of the American people. And it, further, more than that, it's also demoralizing us because it's a lie. And a nation that is deceived is not a free nation. So what I really want to try to do is, what I'm dedicated to doing is trying to undeceive the American people about this deception. It's a dual deception, you know, one that is hand in glove. And when it's very simple. When they listen to the presentation and in 50 minutes, they get it. And then they can communicate that to other people, and that, you know, it's spreading like wildfire.
You know, when a researcher like myself in Australia, in one of the most isolated capital cities in the world, in Perth, Western Australia, when I can find a Craigslist ad looking for crisis actors for events like Orlando, which I found just recently, call for 75 security guards to be crisis actors, when I can find this online, I consider they've done this so often, they're just getting sloppy now. They don't care anymore.
Well, yeah, you're probably right, you know, and it's like there is a degree of sloppiness, you know, like, I mean, it's exposed in the very first day. When they had the shooting in San Bernardino, one of the eyewitnesses in San Bernardino spoke to an anchor on mainstream media news, national TV news, and she said she saw three men and that they were tall white men dressed in black who were doing the shooting. But then at the end of the day, who did they kill? They killed a small Pakistani, brown-skinned Pakistani girl and her husband, who apparently had been killed before they had been dumped out of the car on the street there. I mean, this is sloppy. But you see, the point is that it's not investigated. None of these things are being investigated by the authorities who should be investigating them, just like 9/11. The person who was supposed to investigate 9/11 was an Israeli guy named Michael Chertoff, who happened to be the Assistant Attorney General of the United States Department of Justice. And mm-hmm. and so he allowed the destruction of the evidence. He allowed the criminal investigation to be completely stifled and stymied and blocked. And so there has been no criminal investigation. Furthermore, there were 3,000 families who had wrongful death suits against the government and military and airlines. And every single one of those families' lawsuits was settled out of court. I mean, this is not America.
I do have to point out, except for the Jersey girls, they continue to this day to ask questions and demand answers.
Yeah, but in terms of having standing in the court with a wrongful death case, they've all settled. Those Jersey girls probably either took the money, they either took the money from the compensation fund, or their case for their loved one was settled in the 96 families who held out. But none of the 9/11 families have any cases still standing. They don't have standing anymore, because once they signed on the dotted line and took the blood money from the U.S. government or from the court, I mean, it's all taxpayer money. But when they took that money, They swore an oath to be secret about it, not to talk about it, not to reveal the amount of money, and they could not litigate further. That's what happened. There are no cases anymore.
And you know, when you talk about the 3,000 number, and I see people like Daniel Lewin that was on one of the flights, supposedly on one of the flights, I do consider that maybe there were not all those names on there, that these were just inserts. Do you think that might be the case with some of them?
I don't know. I don't know about that, but I do know there were very few people on every plane, and I do know also that the two planes landed, for example, in Cleveland Airport. One was said to be United Airlines Flight 93. I think the other one was Delta 1989, and that Flight 93 was the same plane that they said was shot down over Shanksville. So what may have happened is that, when Flight 93 landed in Cleveland, they took the people off the plane into the John Glenn NASA facility at the north end of the airport, where they were interrogated by the FBI. I mean, what's going on here? So then it may have been some sort of like culling of the people, and certain people were put on the plane that was shot down. I mean, something like that may have happened. Because we certainly have, you know, a few hundred missing people that were on the planes. Where'd they go?
And I think it's, personally, I think it's unprecedented for them to publish the manifest flight list of all the people on the plane the day of the attacks. Like they had all this information ready to go. Does it seem like that to you?
Yes, and those initial passenger lists did not include the names of the hijackers. And I called up,
right,
you know, United and American in the first few days after 9/11. I said, you know, why is it that your passenger list does not have a list of these hijackers? And they said, well, that's because we have to get the permission from the families. It's nonsense. You don't have the permission from the families. If you have a passenger list, you have a passenger list. And the passenger,
yeah, a lot of this,
you know, it's just hooey. They're just lying. I mean, you know, they got so many lies. I went to the Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and I spoke to a local paper there. I wanted to ask them how they covered the event. And they said, come in on Wednesday at 3 o'clock. And I went in there Wednesday at 3 o'clock. And I was taken into a back room of the newspaper and sat down with a U.S. Navy, a U.S. military intelligence guy named Livernight. And I asked him, why am I talking to you? And he said, I've been seconded to the paper to answer your questions. And I asked him, can you tell me why we don't find any parts of an aircraft in the hole in that reclaimed mine where the plane supposedly crashed? And he said, well, it's very simple. He said, when the plane was going very fast and the ground was very soft, he said the ground liquefied and swallowed the plane. But he said one wing bounced and flew in the woods a half a mile. I mean, this is the kind of lies that have been given to the American people, you know, for years. And if this is not resisted by the entire population, and if these liars are not, you know, booked for their lies, this can't go on. It has to end.
The plane liquefying into soft ground, that sounds like an addition of the Twilight Zone to me.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sure. Oh, do you support the stop funding of Israel?
Well, I think absolutely. I think that that we should not be giving any money to the state of Israel. Nor should anybody else. It's an outlaw state. It violates all kinds of international law. For example, that it develops nuclear weapons arsenal without being a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, things like that. U.S. law and international law actually prohibit us from supporting a state that violates laws like that. Yet we continue to do that. And you know, it's so that obviously we have to stop funding that state. The Europeans have to stop funding that state, and we have to call that state to account for its criminal behavior. Because
Absolutely.
What has happened is they've let this country go along, they've let this Israel, this little Israel, go along with its criminal behavior for so long that it's turned into a Frankenstein. It's just a monster.
Well, please,
you know,
please do stay online for me, Mr. Bullen. We're going to have to definitely get you again because we got so many other questions from the listeners, and certainly we're running out of time here. But I'd like to thank you on behalf of everybody listening and tell the listeners to visit your website at bullen.com, spelled BOLLYN.com, and buy your two fantastic books called Solving 9/11. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad we finally got together. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely, and you're very, very well informed, and I am certainly going to have to buy your books and check them out. Join us coming up soon on the People Speak show when I talk with researcher Henry Macau and Kurt Haskell. Stay tuned for those interviews coming up soon. Big thanks today go out to the producers Mike, Doug, and Donald, and to Earthplay, and all my friends throughout the world. To all the guys who give me so much support, thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel, but for me for now, take care, and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.